Welcome to Trent Voices, the Trent University Alumni Affairs show on Trent Radio. I'm your host, Donald Fraser of Alumni Affairs. It is Monday, June the 8th, and this is episode 7. Today on the show, we have a bit of Canadian entertainment royalty. He's the president of Epitome Pictures, which produce a host of shows, including Instant Star. He's one of the founders of the Songwriters Association of Canada. He's a former director and chair of the Canadian Academy of Recording Arts and Sciences. He was the executive producer of the Junos for nearly 20 years, an executive producer of Canada's first primetime soap, Riverdale. He has 2 Canadian Top 10 musical hits and 11 Canadian Screen Awards. Have you guessed who it is yet? No? Well, maybe this will help. Whatever it takes, I know I can make it through. If I hold out, I know I can make it through. Be the best that I can be. Whatever it takes, I know I can make it. I can make it. That was Canadian electropop sensation Lights doing a rare and unreleased version of the theme to Degrassi, The Next Generation. And you only get to play that version of the Degrassi tune if you have the executive producer of Degrassi himself in your studio. And ladies and gentlemen, the man who wrote that piece of music and the man who produces Degrassi, The Next Generation, the extremely talented, extremely gracious Stephen Stone is with us today. Thank you for being here, Stephen.
It's very nice to be here, Donald. Yeah,
it's wonderful. You know, I'm listening to that Lights cover, and it's fantastic, and it's also a bit surprising, and it's not easy to find. Tell me a little bit about that cover.
I think probably only 5 people in the world until this moment have ever heard that
cover. A great
cover.
Exclusive.
Yes. Because it was back in 2010, we wanted to do a new version of the Degrassi theme, and we asked Lights, and she was totally into it, and reworked her schedule. She was going off to London and coming back, but she went into the studio and did this. We loved it. For whatever reason, the broadcaster in the U.S. didn't, and so we never went forward with it, but I think we were talking earlier, and I know you liked it, and I was listening to it myself just before this interview and thinking, that's really good. Is there any way we could bring it back now and use it as a theme? So we'll see.
Yeah, you know, and I think it would resonate with people. Lights is on her way up as a Canadian music sensation, and I think people would really relate to that kind of electropop.
And by the way, we worked with Lights on our Instant Star series as a songwriter.
Oh, yes.
And her name wasn't Lights then. I won't say what her name was because she probably only likes to be known as Lights.
Well, she's fantastic. And we're going to get into a bit more about that side of your career. In fact, a number of things that have peppered your career that people will know about. But I'm going to start back at the beginning. And well, not at the beginning of you, but back when you were at Trent University. You were one of the founders of Trent Radio. And Trent Radio was the folks getting the first crack at this interview. I'm sure we'll use it in other places as well. But it's going to be there first. Now, looking back at Trent Radio, back when you were at Trent, how did that come about? What did that fledgling Trent Radio look like?
You know, back in those days, there was just a relatively small group of us, and we needed to start a lot of the institutions, whether it was the government, and there were great battles in the government between university-wide governance and college governance, the newspaper, Arthur. Mm-hmm. And Arthur came first, and then and I worked on Arthur and actually gave it its name. But you carry on, and by third year, there was a new editor for Arthur, and I was thinking, what can we do? I love this media area. Mm-hmm. And so we had this idea for what we called Radio Free Arthur.
Oh, cool.
And it would be what has turned into Trent Radio.
Now, I've heard a little bit about the production standards of Trent Radio at the time. I've heard stories of how shows were getting to air. Why don't you take us a little bit through what Trent Radio would have looked like at the time.
Donald, you would laugh so much because we had no idea what a radio station was, how we were supposed to do things.
Yeah.
First of all, we worked out of the language laboratory. Mm-hmm. Peter Northrup had the language lab set up, and there was a recording booth in there. And a four-track tape recorder. We'd never seen a four-track tape recorder.
Yeah.
And so we'd start off, first of all, we had to create some auditions and just try and figure out, well, what kind of voice sounds good on radio? So people would come in, and we wrote a piece of gibberish, which I was told that people actually may still use to this day, which went something like, you know, Trent University President and Vice Chancellor T.H.B. Simons came out swinging last night as he unleashed a scathing attack, and it sort of went on like that. And we'd have everyone try that. Mm-hmm. Then we did a university-wide survey as to what was to be on the radio. And oddly enough, we actually followed the survey to the letter. So if 17% responded that they wanted jazz, we tried to have 17% on the air with jazz. It was a stupid
very
thing to do when you think about it.
Yes, that's right.
And we had on the top of the hour something called University Calendar.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just a roundup of what went on. But I do remember in the early days, we didn't know how to be an announcer. We didn't know how to breathe. We knew nothing about programming. And the announcer on University Calendar would sort of start in, and the tape would be rolling because we had tape in those days.
Yeah.
And he'd get, you know, a few seconds in, and then he'd go, take it again, and then take it again. And these feet of tape were just sort of rolling onto the floor by the end of University Calendar for this tiny five-minute segment.
And there was no transmitter here.
There was no transmitter. We put it on tape. There was 4 hours on Sunday evening, and we took it down to CKPT AM.
Yeah.
And they broadcast, I think it was 7 to 11 on Sunday evenings, and what was then called CHEX FM.
Yeah.
Is it called The Wolf now?
Yes, it's The Wolf and Cruz. And actually, the guy recording this, Michael Hercombe, done a lot of work with them as well.
So, cool.
It's a small world here in Peterborough.
Yeah.
So how many shows were there? I mean, if you're peddling these things downtown, how many shows did you guys manage to pull off?
Well, I mean, we did 4 hours a week.
Yeah.
And that was a lot to us.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, we dreamed of one day, you know, could you ever have a transmitter? Could you be broadcasting a lot of the time and much more music? But it was a lot of work for us to come up with and write scripts for 4 hours a week.
How was it received? Do you remember what Peterborough and the greater Trent community thought of?
Well, the truth was that on Sunday evenings, mm-hmm. because it wasn't a ubiquitous experience, people didn't sort of wake up and turn on Trent Radio to find out what was happening. You had to be there on Sunday evening. And really, who listens to radio on Sunday evening? Which was part of the reason that CKPT and CHEX FM were quite happy to have us on the air then, because there were probably three listeners, and we boosted it up to maybe 50 or something like that.
So you mentioned before Arthur, Arthur is still going strong. It's still flying the flag. It's still, I think it's probably Trent's still main means of getting information of what's going on, at least at the student level. I'm going to talk about your involvement in Arthur in a second, but you mentioned it, the name. Where did Arthur come from?
Well, again, back in the days, when I first started, there was a weekly type of newspaper that sort of existed, and we would create it. I say we because I volunteered to be part of it. And it was created on a thing called a Gestetner machine, mm-hmm. which was, it had a piece of wax paper that you would type onto, which would punch a hole in the paper. You'd put it on a roll, force ink through it, and then you'd hand crank it through, and the ink would come out onto the page. And we were not the editors of the paper. We were sort of the lowly minions who were responsible for actually cranking it out each week. There was no... it was just called the Trent Newsletter, and people said, well, it has to have a proper name.
Mm-hmm.
But nobody could come up with a name. So every week we would put a new name. Someone would call it something, you know, which wouldn't have been bad, the Trent Telegram.
Yeah.
People had names like the Stony Creek Gazette, I think, and the Stentorian. I've never figured out what Stentorian means.
No, and I've seen copies of it, though. So.
And then one week, my friend Jeffrey O'Brien and I, it was 1 o'clock in the morning, everything had gotten delayed. We still didn't have a name for the paper. We had we used to stencil the name on the top, and it was the last page we were going to print, and we didn't have a name.
Yeah.
And Jeffrey said, what are we going to do? And I just said, let's call it Arthur. And the we just roared with laughter.
Yeah.
We were punch drunk at 1 o'clock in the morning and thought that was the stupidest thing that we could ever have suggested. And the reason it was suggested, by the way, had nothing to do with the sword in the water and sort of the Trent symbol. It was, I was a great fan. I'd seen the Beatles movie A Hard Day's Night 17 times.
Yep.
And when George Harrison is asked in the movie what he calls his haircut, he replied, Arthur. And so so we put on Arthur, and if you had told me it would have even lasted one more week, let alone nearly 50 years, I would never have believed it.
Well, and it's become iconic, and you can't take a look at that newspaper and not think Arthur. And, and no one blinks an eyelash at it anymore. And,
yes. Now, does anybody still call it The Arthur?
It does. It does. It happens all the time. People mention The Arthur newspaper.
And we'd always go, no. It's Arthur.
I've had my knuckles wrapped before by putting the name The Arthur in print.
Right.
So that legacy lives on. Now, what did that paper look like in the early days?
Well, in the early days, as I say, it was because we ran about 8 pages, and we had little sketched-in headings like sports. And but over the year, we learned about this magical invention called offset printing. Which we actually had it printed down at the Examiner, and you could do things like you would actually punch a hole in the paper and paste in a negative for photographs, and you would type it and you could correct it, and it actually started to look much better, and it expanded from there. It was very rudimentary at first. We did do, though, April Fool's editions.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that's still a tradition.
No, it's not, but that'd be...
Yes. So I think the first one, that huge headline with a picture of Tom Simons was No Way for Trent System, or something like this, because we all talked about the Trent System and how wonderful it was. And if Tom had ever said that, that would have been a real foo-for-aw. But it turned out that when you went to page two, it wasn't Tom Simons, it was Ed Simons, whatever.
It's what I find really fascinating. So you mentioned the fact that you were working with Czechs Radio at the time for Trent Radio, and then we look at the relationship that you had with the Examiner. Trent has always prided itself in maintaining that town and gown mentality, that we wanted to make sure that we were working really closely with the community. How did those relationships get forged?
Well, remember back in the day, I was not alone, we all wore gowns, and we wore gowns into the city. We wore gowns with our bicycles on. When I first came to Trent, in theory, Champlain College was supposed to be open, and it wasn't.
Yeah.
So for the first fall and a bit on into winter, we were all boarded downtown. We had bicycles, and we go down to Rubich Hall on our bicycles with our gowns.
Yeah.
And, the town was so welcoming. And that tradition petered out, and more than one gown got caught in bicycle spokes, and people would go over. But we were very aware of the importance of the community back then.
The community for me is a huge thing, and I'm a Trent and Peterborough music nerd. I can't help it, and we feature a lot of music on this show. For some reason, we've guessed that there's something in the water. The tradition of musical excellence in Peterborough and Trent University has been astounding. In the 60s, you had folks like Ian Tamblyn, Stan Rogers, your buddy Christopher Ward. You go through the decades. Right now, we've got bands like the Silverhearts, Television Road. These are people that have great musical legacy, and it's not just limited to the Peterborough area. You went on to write a couple of Canadian top 10 hits with Christopher. Were you engaged in the music scene here?
Oh, absolutely. Christopher in particular was part of the folk club.
Yeah.
And we decided he did some proper folk music with Marg Edmondson, and it was really good sounding stuff. And then we created our own fictional group called Cookies and Milk. There was Captain Cookies and Major Milk. And we never said which one of us was Captain Cookies or Major Milk. That remains a mystery to this day.
Maybe we'll get to the bottom of that. Right.
But we would do things like Everly Brothers songs with high falsetto harmonies.
Oh, gorgeous.
And it was really fun. And we actually carried that on. It's a very long story that I will keep very, very short.
Yep.
After university for about a year, Chris and I traveled in Europe in a Volkswagen van playing songs in various locations, including on board a U.S. destroyer. In Ankara, Turkey, we played at the Playboy Club for about 8 weeks, just to make enough money to keep going and to keep the van being repaired. And it was during that time that we started really trying to write our own songs. Mm-hmm. And when we came back, we traveled so much together. Christopher doesn't remember this as clearly as I did, but I didn't want to be in the same place as him.
Yeah.
When we'd been traveling, it wasn't always just the two of us. There were quite often a lot of our Trent friends would mm-hmm. come over, and because we had a van, you could have seven of us traveling around. It was really quite fun. But when we came back, I was quite happy not to see Christopher anymore. But a couple of years later, he came to me and said, you know, Warner Brothers wants to sign me to a recording contract, and you're in law school. Do you think you could help me? And I said, well, no, I'm in law school. I'm not a lawyer, but I can put you in touch with someone who can help. And he said, would you like to hear the song that Warner Brothers wanted to put out as a single? And I said, sure. And he played the song for me, and I said, man, that is a beautiful song. I understand exactly why they want to sign you.
Yeah.
And he looked at me, and he looked at me, and he stared, and then he said, you idiot. And then I realized why I didn't really want to see him too much anymore. And he said, no, don't you remember, you wrote that song when we were in the Playboy Club in Ankara, Turkey. I've changed the lyrics.
Yeah.
And sure enough, it was a song called Lost in a Love Song, which got up the country charts in Canada. And that was the first single. And then we went on to write songs like Once in a Long Time and Maybe Your Heart.
Well, you know what? And I'm going to pause here for a moment. And I'm going to play DJ for a second. And I'm going to play a snippet from a song, Once in a Lifetime, from the 70s. We'll be right back.
Night, summer moon is a diamond in the sky. Feel a perfect feeling, feel yourself believing. Summer moon forever fills the sky. As the midnight flies, the touch of a love.
Okay, Stephen. So that's the musical Wayback Machine, a top 10 Canadian hit, and you're a co-writer on this tune. I've seen some interviews with you, and you say that you are that you're not a wordsmith. I think the word you used was banal when talking yes. about your abilities as a lyricist. That you're more of a melody guy, and so. When you sit down with Christopher Ward, or even now, but flashing back to the 70s, what does that songwriting partnership look like then?
It was very much today, and I understand you're going to be interviewing Christopher in a couple
yes.
of weeks, and ask him about this, because back in the day, the songwriting was, at least for us, and I think because our idols were, of course, Lennon and McCartney and people mm-hmm. like Brian Wilson, was a long process. You'd come up with a snippet of an idea, and you'd work on it, and then you'd put it away, and you'd come back, and it could take months. Now, not to say that there wasn't some songs that you created in like 30 minutes,
yeah.
but a lot of them you would polish. I might come up with a melody with dummy lyrics and give it to Christopher, and he might suggest a different structure, come up with some more proper lyrics, and we'd go back and forth over a period of an extended period of time. Today, and you'll find out more from Christopher, it's more of a it's a speed writing exercise where a group of writers will get into a room and 3 hours later will come out, not just with a song, but actually with a pretty well-produced song. I mean, it may take another few hours for the track person to, you know, mix it and get it together. But it's not a master recording by then, but it's pretty darn close to a master recording. So it's different now.
It's a completely different world. I mean, people are making music in their basements. And this, I think it's an era of, you know, the 30-minute song. And then it gets pumped up through production values.
Christopher calls it collage culture.
Yeah.
Because you've got writers like Dr. Luke who are really like 40 different writers.
Yeah.
And you take the best of what Ed wrote and add it to the best of what Jenna did and mix it all together. And then Taylor Swift adds her patina on it. And all of a sudden it's a hit.
Well, I mean, in the same light, you're an innovator. You proved that early on in your time at Trent by helping to found both Trent Radio and Arthur. So you have a love of songwriting and a proven track record in that. Is the combination of that what led to the creation of the Songwriters Association of Canada?
Oh, very much so. I mean, songwriters are a downtrodden, lonely lot. When you think of artists, they get the adulation. Now, with the adulation comes, you know, the downside, the paparazzi, if they're very famous. The songwriters have it both good and bad. The good is that they're not bothered. Nobody really cares who the songwriter is. He could walk into the middle of a room and having written a hit, and you know the people, the fans, all go towards the artist.
Yeah.
But the songwriting existence is a lonely one, and they tend not to be really strong at standing up and lobbying for their own rights.
Mm-hmm.
They tend to be more withdrawn and write into their art, which is exactly the way they should be. So when we formed the Songwriters Association, I was a lawyer, we really were looking to help strengthen Canada's copyright laws, which were woefully weak at the time. And so as a young lawyer and working with you know, people like Eddie Schwartz, who is one of the top songwriters in the world, and Christopher, I think, was out of the country at the time, or we would have gotten him involved in the early days of the Songwriters Association. But it really was to build a forum that could speak on behalf of songwriters who weren't, it wasn't within them to go and lobby for themselves. They just wanted to be off writing. So that was the genesis of it.
And then on the flip side of this, we've got your involvement in the Canadian Academy of Recording Arts and Sciences. So we've got the songwriter side, we've got the introspective, and then we've got the recording arts and sciences. What was the evolution in direction there?
Well, CARIS is the organization behind the Juno Awards.
Yeah.
Now, it does a lot of things other than the Juno Awards, but I worked with them for a long while. You know, obviously working on Degrassi, I'm very used now. We're coming up to nearly 500 episodes of Degrassi. Jeez. This year we'll see the 500th episode of the Degrassi franchise. The Junos, when you think of a television show that's 2 hours long, is a very different experience and a very exciting experience. Mm-hmm. On a Degrassi episode, you have the chance to go back and edit, and even, if necessary, to reshoot. We try not to do that.
Yeah.
But if something isn't working, you've got a chance to fix it. And, you know, you've got time before you're going on the air. It may be three months before the scheduled air date. With the Junos, at 8 o'clock on Sunday evening, the red light is going on.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter if the electricity has failed in the building. It doesn't matter if the singer has a cold and the microphone is turned off. You're going on the air. And there's something really wonderful about that rush.
Well, I imagine that the role is a combination, part lion tamer, part ringleader, 100% circus, and in a room full of egos, because these are songwriters, but they're also the performers, which means that you have those outlandish personalities.
Oh, the performers and their managers.
And their managers.
That's right.
So how stressful was it?
It's interesting. There's a saying that somebody told me a long time ago, and I thought was really true. It's that a person can accomplish almost anything if they're willing not to take credit for it. So if you're willing to step back and allow the egos to thrive, yeah. and just because behind those egos are incredible talents and thoughts, and really just genuinely listen and try and create a consensus, it's amazing how things can move forward. But yes, there were some, there have been some very tense moments in the past.
I'm not going to drag you any further, because then we'd have to get into naming names.
Yes.
And
yes.
My assistant Jenna was stoked about the fact that that you were coming in. I think that there might have been a squeal of delight that I heard from the office next door when I mentioned Degrassi, The Next Generation, and when I played the theme. And although I'm a bit old for your Degrassi, I'm a kids Degrassi era kind of guy. We had a little sing along in the office when we played the Degrassi
song.
Thing. So before we get to the show itself, I want to give the millennials of the listeners, our students and some of our grads, a bit of a treat. And we're going to play the full length Degrassi theme. Tell me a bit about. Well, first of all, how you came up with this particular theme, and then the evolution of how it became
Well, the theme has evolved, and when we brought back Degrassi in 2001, we wanted a theme that was empowering.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were sitting around, there was two others and myself, and we came up with this phrase that whatever it takes, you can make it through. And then it really just built itself from there. But we thought, we're appealing to young people. I think we should have, why don't we try and have a kids choir?
Yeah.
So we thought, let's have a kids choir in the background. We got Lisa Del Ballo in to sing. We had a few different attempts at it. And then it started to come together, and we thought, this is empowering. Just be the best, and whatever it takes, you can make it through. So that was really the beginning, and it's evolved since then. The extended version that you're talking about, a few years later, we wanted to put it out on a soundtrack in the mm-hmm. United States. Our U.S. broadcaster wanted to do something. We thought, well, 30 seconds isn't long enough, so why don't we just extend it out?
Yeah.
And so we added a rap section in the middle.
And it's a great recording. Let's take a quick listen to it.
Up's tough when you think of the things you did. Everybody's always trying to show you the way and telling you to work, and all you want to do is play, and your friends want to hang, go out and have a blast, laughing and they joking at the back of the class, and you want to dance, have a good time and relax, sitting with your friends and your favorite tracks. I'm saying sometimes life is a place we don't get. You know you'll make it through, just believe, and you'll set an example of what you want to be, what you want to see. Use your imagination, be free. Life is a place we don't always get. You gotta take a risk and you gotta make a bet. And it seems sometimes that things are kinda mess. But hang on and don't let yourself get stressed, just breathe. Cause it's up to you what you need. Whether you follow, whether you lead, believe in your dreams and you'll get where you're going. See what you need, guaranteed you'll be flowing. People come and go, it's a part of the game. But your true friends always gonna stand the same. No matter what'll happen, you will know what is true. And guess what? I know I can make it. Come on. Yeah.
And that was the extended version of the theme to Degrassi, The Next Generation. With me here today is the writer of that piece of music and the executive producer of the television show Degrassi, The Next Generation, Stephen Stone. Stephen, tell me about your involvement with Degrassi and how the new show came to life.
Well, I'll go back to 1979. This is not the new show. This was the first show. I didn't know Linda Schuyler at the time. She was a school teacher. But through a series of events, she'd found this little book called Ida Makes a Movie, and she wanted to make a little movie. She had $5,000 she'd raised from family and friends, and she wanted to make a movie. So she needed to buy the rights to a book and was directed to this bright young lawyer, just newly called to the bar, named Stephen Stone. And I gave her some of the best legal advice in my life, which was, don't use a lawyer. I said, you know, this is a small book. It's out of print. If you use a lawyer, they'll use a lawyer. It will get all complicated.
Yeah.
Here's a form. I won't charge you for it. For the assignment of all audiovisual rights of whatsoever nature or kind, now or hereafter known. And just, you know, offer them $200 and see what they say.
Yeah.
And she took that advice. Well, it turned out that Ida Makes a Movie was the first of the kids of Degrassi Street.
Okay.
And I didn't actually speak with Linda again for a couple of years until CBC, who had initially hadn't really taken to Degrassi, but after she produced another couple of them, they'd said, hey, listen, we can put these on the air. And they did a few more. And then they thought, why don't we age it up a little bit and do Degrassi Junior High? And at that point, with a higher budget, she said, I think I need a lawyer to help me through all this. Wait a minute, who was that nice young man who gave me free legal advice? And yeah. She's paid very dearly for it ever since.
I know that you've got the inside track when it comes to Degrassi, but this is an iconic piece of Canadiana. Were you nervous tinkering with what so many young people and so many adults remember as a part of their youth?
Well, when we brought Degrassi back, and originally we hadn't intended to bring it back. Mm-hmm. We'd been working on a teen soap opera called Ready, Willing, and Wired. And, you know, one day we started to realize, and the Wired part was very important because the internet was just coming in then, cell phones were really important, and we realized, hey, the teen life may be very similar in many ways, but it's the technology is evolving. But we realized that one of the characters from Degrassi Junior High, young Emma, who had been born to Spike in grade 7, would now be 13 years old.
Yeah.
And she could actually be attending Degrassi. We thought maybe Ready, Willing, and Wired should be all about Emma. I'm a Star Trek fan, which is where the name The Next Generation came from. But Linda, in particular, was extremely worried. In her own mind, she was thinking, well, people say, I don't really have any new ideas, so I keep coming back. There were the kids at Degrassi Street, then I did Degrassi Junior High, now it's then Degrassi High, and I can't think of anything else to do. I mean, we'd been doing other shows, but, you know, do I keep going back to the well? And I really tried to encourage her and say, you know, let's just try it. But she worried so much over those first few years because it wasn't a hit right off the top back in 2001. It was got enough ratings that we would carry on. It was only by season 3 or 4 that it really took off.
Well, there must be a lot of parents who are really excited to introduce their kids to Degrassi as well. I mean, it's a generational thing. So
it is a generation, and the next generation has really become the next generation. Mm-hmm. And indeed, we're starting season 15 now. We may even change the name of the show to we're thinking of calling it Degrassi Next Class, because we realize that we are now in an entirely new generation again.
Degrassi, obviously very public. The Junos, obviously very public. These are things that as viewers, we see, but you've got a lot going on behind the scenes. You mentioned that you are a lawyer. You're a founding partner in the law firm Stone Hay Cafrazzo Dombrowski Richmond LLP. I'm sorry if I murdered any of those names. What does the legal side of entertainment look like for you?
I love the legal side. You know, when you're dealing with recording artists, in particular songwriters, these are not people who are born business people. Mm-hmm. So it's not just a question of like real estate law where somebody comes in and says, I'd like to buy, you know, this particular house, and there's forms to deal with. A lot of it is talking with the client and really becoming part of the decision-making team of the client, working with them, the managers, and others, and being partly a businessman in addition to being a lawyer. So it's always been fascinating to me because it's a very creative side of the law. And I worked in a very large law firm. I was a partner for 10 years at McCarthy's, which is one of the biggest law firms in Canada, hundreds and hundreds of lawyers. But when I left McCarthy's in the mid-90s to join Linda, and we bought a building which has now been turned into four different studios. We now lease other spaces, so actually seven different studios and two back lots, which is where we shoot Degrassi. I left the big firm. But, you know, we thought, buying a building, we don't know very much about that. Is it going to work? Will Degrassi continue? Yeah. It'd be nice if you had something to fall back on. So I formed this small entertainment law firm that now has 8 or 9 lawyers doing nothing but entertainment law, working with whether it's film production companies or internet creators or songwriters or artists.
It's incredible how many fingers you have in various pies across the entertainment industry. And in 2005, the government of Ontario gave you a commendation. It read in part, Stephen Stone, you are no stranger to Canadian show business, having worked and excelled in nearly all facets of the industry. You seem to have worn every possible hat, from performing artist to accomplished entertainment lawyer, and in doing so, have amassed an incomparable wealth of knowledge and experience. Your skills and expertise have stood you in good stead, propelling you from success to success. Whether producing the internationally acclaimed television series Degrassi, The Next Generation, or playing a key role in the development of Epitome Pictures, you take on challenges in a manner appropriately echoed by the words of the legendary Samuel Goldwyn, "All opportunities in the world are waiting to be grasped by people who are in love with what they are doing." You love what you are doing. Where does the energy and this wellspring of creativity come from? What drives you to keep on going forward?
The passion, I've asked myself this question before, the passion is not so much creating something. I mean, okay, I do love that going back and thinking of, you know, writing songs like Once in a Long Time, those were really great moments. But really, it's the process of working with creative, talented people.
Okay.
And if you've got a bunch of people that you can work with who are, you know, really talented and creative, undoubtedly they have a great sense of humor, that's a pretty good way to wake up in the morning and to go off to work with people like that. And the other side of it is, and you mentioned that I've done a number of things, and it sounds like, well, how many hours in the day does this guy have? Well,
I was wondering if there are Stephen Stone hours or something that other people don't have.
The reality is, if you touch in to a particular, to a meeting, and you're not in the weeds, you're just sort of listening, you're feeding back what people are saying, you're energizing them and supporting them in their own decisions, sometimes you can just see something because you're looking at it from afar and just ask a question, and people go, oh, that's a good question. And then you go off into another meeting entirely, and it's a different thing. It may be a legal thing. It may be a, you know, you're in a music mix, and you've just got something. It's a different perspective because you're not involved all the time in it. Having said that, there are some things that I love getting right down into the weeds on, and one of them is the music and sound side of Degrassi in particular.
It's really interesting. So you talk about the collaborative process, you talk about these small groups, you talk about differing ideas that come into a situation which help with your output. This all resonates for me as a Trent University academic experience. That is these tables that we sat around in for tutorials. How did your time at Trent, your Trent academic experience, factor in or inform the work that you do today?
You could be writing the speech that I will be giving tomorrow at Convocation. I mean, I've already written the speech, but it exactly answers that question.
You can give me credit for that if you would like.
That's true. Trent was absolutely formative. The Trent way of thinking, I majored in philosophy and economics. Mm-hmm. I mean, two very disparate use of language, patterns of thinking. But that's the kind of thing that Trent really promotes. So you add the extracurricular onto that, working on the radio station, the social events, the newspaper. So your mind just thinks in different ways with different, whether it's philosophy, economics, or playing in a band. And that kind of expansiveness, we used to call it a Renaissance mode of thinking. It's really the Trent way of thinking. And I think it's quite unique, and it is completely a foundation to everything I've done for the rest of my life.
Tomorrow, you are getting an honorary degree from Trent University. How does it feel to be recognized by the school that housed you back then?
It's absolutely wonderful. It is not just an institution to me. Mm-hmm. You said, I think, at the very beginning of the show, well, let's go back to the beginning of your life. And you said, well, no, not the beginning of your life, just, let's go back to Trent. But in many ways, Trent was the beginning of my life. It was the place where so many things opened up for me. And it was the Trent way of thinking. Of course, it was a new university, so we were all learning, including the professors. Mm-hmm. We were all trying out the system and seeing what worked and what didn't work. But the patterns of thinking and people that I met have remained in my life, and I can trace almost everything that I've done since then back to my days here at Trent, and I'm very, very grateful to it and delighted to be given an honorary doctorate.
Well, we're honored that you're here and that you're sharing some of your time and your knowledge and your experience with us. You're always busy. You are an incredibly busy guy. What's next? What's on the horizon for Stephen Stone?
You know, it drives my wife crazy because I say I'm 67 years old now. I'd like to work till I'm about 99, and then cut down to maybe 3 days a week.
Yeah,
I have no desire to cut back. The industry, the television industry, right now is going through absolute chaos, as the move is really in force now. Coming, people just, particularly young people, are not watching television per se anymore. They're all online. And that's changing all the paradigms. Netflix is coming on strong. Mm-hmm. But soon there'll be real competitors to Netflix as the major broadcasters start moving their programming more and more online and making it more accessible online. The music industry's gone through a tremendous revolution.
Absolutely.
But even now, the move to streaming away from downloads, that is changing. We live in a world where every year or so now, things are just around us are changing so dramatically. To be privileged to be a part of it and to try and react and try and guess how things are going, I don't want to miss a second of it.
And if I were to gaze into a crystal ball, looking at your success in riding the waves of pop, and by pop I mean popular culture, whether it be television or music, you've always been right there, and I'm willing to put heavy money on the fact that you're going to continue to lead this revolution, Stephen.
Well, thank you very much.
No, thank you, and thank you for being here. We are out of time. I know you've got a busy couple days ahead of you. You're here for Convocation for the honorary degree. And again, congratulations on that. So thank you for being here. We are going to go out with one more piece of music, and I let you choose it. Can you set it up for our audience?
We talked about a whole bunch of things that I've accomplished. What we never talk about, because people forget about them, is things that are not successes. And there's tons of those in my life as well. It's just that they go by the board. Nobody paid any attention to them. There's a song called Almost Heaven that Christopher and I wrote. Mm-hmm. It was around the time we were writing songs like Once in a Long Time and Maybe Your Heart that were extremely successful. We got a group of young women, including Cheryl Davies, who recently was, I think, president of the Alumni Association here. She was a great singer. Back in the day, Cheryl and I actually sang with Stan Rogers in a group together for a while. We got Cheryl and a couple of other young women, called them the Cover Girls, and we created a few songs. And they were sort of like a Cherrelle's kind of group. Cheryl was the lead singer in a song called Almost Heaven. And so you can listen to her now. But at the very end of the song, we thought we'd do something different. We were creating cascading harmonies and thought, how do we bring it down? The Beach Boys had an album out at the time, a party album. So we thought, well, why don't we create a party in the studio? Now, it was really only four of us in the studio. So we just kept overdubbing and clapping and, you know, making noises and talking. But anyway, why don't we play Almost Heaven, or at least a part of it, featuring Cheryl Davies.
Yet another example of Stephen Stone being innovative. Congratulations again on your honorary degree. Have fun tomorrow.
Thank you so much, Donald.
And that, my friends, was Canadian entertainment mogul Stephen Stone. And this has been Trent Voices. That's it for this week. We will see you again next week.
Up from the boardwalk, it's a limo drive with a live wire on your radio. You can hear everything that you never heard. Turn up the treble real high and dig the word. Direct from the singer to you, down on Dreamland Avenue. Almost heaven, center stage in a jukebox story. Rise and you're chasing